And now we'll start the debate. For the motion, Heather McDonald.
Thank you very much. I will argue that stress interrogation techniques were both necessary for getting information from suspected terrorists after 9/11 and effective in doing so. I will base my arguments on the actual experience of interrogators in Afghanistan and elsewhere. This is not a debate about torture. The stress methods that interrogators developed, such as short periods of sleep deprivation and isolation, were light years from torture. And to call them such degrades the moral opprobrium that rightly attaches to the term. As my colleagues will demonstrate, the use of stress techniques on terrorists is lawful. The burden, therefore, falls on our opponents to explain why legal and essential methods to gain critical information about future terrorist attacks should be off limits. It didn't take long for interrogators working in Afghanistan to realize that the traditional army interrogation techniques were nearly useless against the Al-Qaeda operatives and Taliban fighters whom the military was picking up in the fall of 2001. Those traditional techniques, a set of 16 psychological gambits assembled during the Cold War, were designed to help young Americans, soldiers, debrief Soviet prisoners of war on the battlefield. The 16 gambits had been crafted for use against conventional soldiers, lowly grunts conscripted into a state army who were often only too glad to be taken off the battlefield and out of the war. Army lore held that 95% of lawful prisoners of war would divulge information upon direct questioning. In Afghanistan, this ratio was reversed. Virtually none of the terror detainees was giving up information. Tried and true approaches, like appealing to a prisoner's love of family, often had little purchase. If an interrogator offered a jihadist prisoner contact with his wife or children in exchange for information, the jihadist might respond, quote, "I've divorced this life. I don't care about my family," end quote. Unlike lawful prisoners of war, the terror detainees were never off the battlefield. They continued their vicious attacks against their captors at every opportunity while in detention. Some of the detainees had been trained in resistance techniques and knew the limits of American interrogation rules. Others quickly learned what those limits were. So the interrogators began cautiously experimenting with stress techniques such as marathon questioning sessions or aggressive behavior to put a detainee on edge. The purpose of such methods was to recreate the shock of capture, that vulnerable mental state immediately following capture when a prisoner is most frightened, uncertain, and likely to give up information. Uncertainty is an interrogator's most powerful ally. It can lead the detainee to believe that the interrogator is in total control and holds the key to his future. An interrogator facing a resistant Taliban explosives maker, for example, might angrily hoist the prisoner up by his collar and storm out of the interrogation booth. The detainee had previously understood that American interrogators couldn't so much as lay a finger on them. Suddenly, he doesn't know what the interrogator's limits are. That frightening uncertainty can change his calculations about whether to cooperate. According to interrogators in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, stress worked. The harsher the methods that the questioners used, the sooner they got good information. Eventually, the military codified a set of stress techniques for use in Guantanamo and Iraq. These included keeping a detainee awake at night, putting them on cold army rations instead of hot meals, isolation, environmental manipulation, and impersonating a foreign agent. All were hedged around with numerous bureaucratic and medical safeguards. None of the stress techniques that the military approved for use on terror detainees had anything to do with Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was the result of the unconscionable and culpable breakdown of military discipline throughout the detention camp. Soldiers sprayed graffiti on the walls, engaged in public sexual misbehavior, and operated bootlegging and prostitution rings. Elliot Spitzer is not known to have used any of them. The guards' sadistic and sexualized treatment of prisoners was an extension of the chaos they were already wallowing in. It had nothing to do with interrogation. Had the rules for prisoner treatment and questioning been followed at Abu Ghraib, the abuse couldn't have happened. In conclusion, the stress interrogation techniques that interrogators developed to break detainees' resistance were necessary, effective, and lawful. They were far from torture. In certain instances, as Bob said, they resembled what Army recruits and professionals go through as part of their training. As a reality check, here's the Senate's definition of torture. It is that barbaric cruelty which lies at the top of the pyramid of human rights misconduct, such as sustained systematic beating, application of electric currents to sensitive parts of the body, and tying up or hanging in positions that cause extreme pain.
One.
It would be reckless to ignore the experience of interrogators on the ground who came up against detainee resistance that was potentially catastrophic in consequence. Intelligence about terror planning is our only sure defense against attack. Nothing else matters. Interrogators facing the urgent need to get life-saving information from terrorists with likely knowledge of future plots should be allowed to use stress when the questioning techniques designed for lawful prisoners of war are not working. Thank you.
Against the motion, John Hudson.
Gee, it all sounds so sweet and benign. Ask them a few questions, have them stand up for a while, they can take their shirt off, give them a little cold maybe. 300-pound Iraqi general, stuffed in headfirst into a sleeping bag, bound up with electrical wires, sat on by an Army warrant officer, hand put over his face every time he screamed out for Allah. Released. Put back in. Died. Dead. That was a stress position. Guy was prosecuted, got 6 months for some orders violations, but basically was released because it was an authorized stress position. Taxi driver Diwali, hung from the ceiling by his wrists. 5 days after he's not captured, but turned over to American forces in exchange for a ransom. Beaten to a point where, according to the autopsy by an Army doctor, his legs are pulpified, dead. By the DOD's own count, approximately 40 people have been killed in the hands of the United States in detention as homicides. So let's not kid ourselves that this is some sort of benign search for the truth. Torture was never intended to be that. Torture was intended originally to be an effort to get false confessions. You're a heretic, you're a traitor to the king, you're a witch. We've given a bad name to torture. We've misapplied torture. We're trying to use it to find the truth, for Pete's sake. My experience has been in doing these kinds of things and with these kinds of groups that there are a number of people who have a number of different points of view about it. Some of you are moved by history, tradition. Some of you are moved by the morality of it, the moral imperative. Some of you are moved by diplomacy. Some of you are simply moved by the practicality of it. Are there better methods, or is this the best method? What I want to do is address six aspects of torture or benign interrogation, whatever you want to call it, stuffing people in sleeping bags headfirst and binding them up. And then give each of you the opportunity to pick the one that you kind of think works, and then my colleagues will hone in on some of them. First one is that it inflames, enrages the enemy, and causes them not to surrender. There's a reason the Nazis surrendered to the Americans on the Eastern Front and not to the Russians. In the first Iraq War, tens of thousands of Iraqis surrendered to us because they knew that they would be treated decently. My friends, they're not surrendering to us anymore. It endangers our own troops. We're the ones on the front lines. It's U.S. troops at the pointy end of the spear, forward deployed in more locations, on more occasions, in greater numbers than all the other forces of this world combined. There was a reason that the United States wanted there to be a Geneva Convention. It wasn't to protect them from us. It was to protect us from them. And we've lost that. John McCain said that he believes that he was treated incrementally better because the Vietnamese knew, North Vietnam knew, that we were abiding by the Geneva Conventions in spite of the fact we didn't have to, according to the arguments based on the same rationale that the administration uses now. It interferes with our ability to build coalitions. In the future, wars are going to be fought by coalition forces. The United States should not and cannot go alone. We were just put on the list of human rights violators by Canada. We got them to take us off, but the point is Canada, the Aussies, the Brits aren't going to want to fight with us if they can't expect us to comply with the Geneva Conventions, and we're going to be out there at the pointy end of the spear all by our lone. It causes Americans to become torturers. It's one thing for us to send our good men and women into battle and ask them to give that last full measure of devotion. It's another thing to send them into battle and ask them to become torturers and come home that way. Fifthly, it's simply not the most effective method. People say, does torture work? Does torture work isn't the right question. The question is there another more effective way to do it? Let me quote to you from, say, General Petraeus, who one would think would know something about it. Some may argue that we would be more effective if we sanctioned torture or other expedient methods to obtain information from the enemy. They would be wrong. Beyond the basic fact that such actions are illegal, history shows that they are frequently neither useful nor necessary.
One.
The fight depends on securing the Boy, that went fast. I just got into this. The fight depends on securing the populations, which must understand that we, not our enemies, occupy the high moral ground. And then finally, and I'd like to return to this because I think it's, if I get another chance, I think it's the most important issue. This is an asymmetric war. In an asymmetric war, you want to pit your greatest strength against the enemy's greatest weakness. Fortunately, in this war, that works for us, if we will do it. Because our greatest strength is our ideas and our ideals. The enemy is completely bereft of ideas and ideals. Thomas Paine said in 1776, "The cause of America is the cause of all mankind." Several hundred years later, that great geopolitical commentator Bono said, "America isn't just a country, it's an idea."
Okay, thank you. For the motion, David Rifkin.
The critics invariably portray, as you just heard now, waterboarding, novice stress techniques as torture. I would stipulate easily and readily that waterboarding and other stress techniques is a fairly unpleasant practice. It offends our 21st century sensibilities. It's something that's difficult to talk about. But I also believe that we're at war with an implacable and ruthless foe. that thinks nothing about killing civilians by the thousands and seeking to kill millions more. I don't think anybody would disagree, but obtaining intelligence is vital in this war. And we can debate, theoretically, the proposition that other techniques work, but it's a matter of fact. There are instances where hardened enemy operatives did not prove susceptible to these kinder, gentler techniques, and yet provided intelligence, then they were subjected to stressful interrogation techniques. But my overarching message to you is that this is a policy debate. It should be a policy debate, which is why asking the question that has been posed today is useful. The obsession of legalities is not helpful. The legal definition of torture is necessarily vague. The torture defined in the 94 statute, which was passed to implement obligations under the Anti-Torture Convention, as, quote, intentional infliction of severe pain or suffering, both physical or mental. Plus, the legal debate about torture boils down to the question of how severe is severe. As far as the physical pain and suffering is concerned, it's almost certainly the case that some forms of waterboarding that have been practiced by the CIA on only three occasions that we know of for three different high-value detainees rise to the level of torture. And some, probably particularly those that do not involve full inundation of a subject, do not. The reason for this is because the physical discomfort suffered by the subject of being subjected to this technique while real is not severe enough. As far as the mental severe pain and suffering is concerned, it bears emphasizing that Congress deliberately adopted a narrow definition of the term severe to encompass only, and I quote, prolonged mental harm caused by or resulting from the threat of imminent death or mind-altering substances. In my view, the waterboarding and other techniques practiced by the CIA do not fit this definition for at least two reasons. First of all, the practice of waterboarding used by the CIA was extremely short, 60 to 90 seconds, which certainly suggests, even to our lawyer, but it's not protracted. Significantly, the question of what constitutes protracted was further debated by Congress in 2005 and 2006 in the context of two key pieces of legislation that Congress handled. And once again, the answer was that there has to be some duration, some timeline for somebody to be considered protracted. Second, the high-value terrorists being interrogated were perfectly aware that they're not in any danger of death, that the CIA was after information, their lives were not in danger. Then Congress passed in Detainee Treatment Act something called Shocks the Conscious Standard, which makes it even harder to argue that these techniques are always inherently and absolutely torture. Because the Shocks the Conscience Standard, by definition, and it's something that borrows from the American case law, it is inherently a context-specific standard. It is not something that you would be able to answer in the abstract. It's also worthy to point out that while the original Justice Department so-called torture memo was perhaps overly broad in its definition of what level of pain and suffering constitutes torture, the Office of Legal Counsel came up with some more nuanced analysis. Significantly, ladies and gentlemen, this analysis was developed by lawyers, at least some of whom were critical of the administration's policy. Indeed, as reported in the media, including by Stuart Taylor of National Journal, the lead author of the subsequent memo by OLC on this issue was none other than senior DOJ official Dan Levin, who himself had himself been subjected to waterboarding as a part of his research. I know that trusting the government is not an argument most of you like these days, but I would certainly be inclined to trust Dan Levin, who, by the way, was reportedly forced out by Alberto Gonzalez for not being sufficiently solicitous of the White House positions on various other issues. Now, presented with this argument, the critics claim, well, maybe it's not torture, but maybe it's cruel and human and degrading treatment, which is another set of legal buzzwords. Yet cruel and human and degrading are even more capacious terms than torture. For some detainees, the mere fact that they're being questioned by a Jew or a woman is an intolerable humiliation. Are we supposed to countenance and approve this kind of racist sentiment? Meanwhile, it's also the case that there have to be some reasonable definition of what is cruel, inhuman, and degrading, because I would submit to you that there is a degree of humiliation, cruelty, and degradation in any kind of custodial interrogation. There's yelling, there's screaming, threats are being made against the person or his loved ones. Andy Faustow of Enron fame was told by his interrogators that his wife would be in prison for a long time, and I would submit to you that it was probably a cruel treatment. So there has to be some parameters of behavior that clearly is cruel and degrading and humiliating, but yet does not violate the law. My bottom line is this. While the waterboarding debate implicates legal issue, we cannot simply abandon the field to the lawyers. The lawyers have no special right or expertise to deal with those issues. It's our duty as a society to approach this debate seriously in a mature fashion, to ask what is really consistent with our values. Incidentally, we talked about mistakes. My good friend John mentioned mistakes. And yes, shoving somebody's head in a sleeping bag is not a good thing. But as you may recall, these problems occur in other contexts. When I was at the Justice Department, one of my responsibilities was investigating various bad things that happened in the Bureau of Prisons. And let me assure you, ladies and gentlemen, in a situation where there is no blessing for stress techniques, instead, in fact, prisoners in federal and civil and state penitentiaries not being interrogated at all, have fellow prisoners who commit horrible things. You have sadistic guards who do horrible things. Recently, I had a case in Florida involving mistreatment by the guards of a child in a boot camp where he was basically smothered and suffocated in the course of trying to set him straight. This is not an easy debate. We should not focus exclusively on the question of how to deal with enemy combatants. We should ask the broader set of questions of what level of coercion are we prepared to tolerate in our public policy, something that our government is doing. We should not come up with one set of regimen for captured unlawful enemy combatants when we waterboard our own personnel. Then there are things going on in other spheres of public life, including, as I mentioned, in boot camps that are harsher. But the last point is, whatever we do, we should be honest and transparent about this debate. We should not use misdirection. We should not talk in terms of, well, let's adopt the same standards as an Army Field Manual. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the Army Field Manual, by the way, allows the level of Mutt and Jeff technique that does not allow the interrogator playing the bad cop to be disrespectful, to be tough on an individual. So here we have politicians advocating the level of kindness towards the unlawful enemy combatants that exceeds that's being adopted with regard to interrogation of criminal suspects. That
Thank
is not
you.
The good way to deal with this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Against the motion, Darius Rajali.
All of us on both sides want good counterterrorism policy. Heather, David, John, all of us want to be safe. All of you want to be safe. They just represent different fears. I'm here to represent the facts, not their fears. I have been working for 30 years on torture, on not torture, and everything I'm about to say is in that 900-page book in the lobby. Bottom line, good torture is not good counterterrorism policy. As the fascist military police said, torture for interrogation is, and I quote, the, quote, clumsiest method, and only a, quote, fool would use it. And this is from their interrogation manual from Burma in 1943. Now, I don't care whether you call it torture, tough stuff, muffin stuff, not torture. The only question really is, as you say, whether it gets the bad guys. And here's where everybody gets into storytelling. You've heard a few. I have one, too. A World War II vet came up to me after the lecture I said, and he said, in France, we caught this German soldier, and we pulled a knife to his throat, and he said, where are the other soldiers? And I said, did you get good info? And he said, yeah, sort of. I said, I'm happy for you. I really am. I really am. Because if you had bad info, you'd be dead. You would be dead. The problem is that everyone who knows that torture, not torture, doesn't work, is dead. For those for whom it works are walking around saying it worked for me, it worked for them. This is what we call in social science a biased sample. If you take real data from the best studies, armies using torture who carefully and selectively selected suspects, 8,000 to 20,000 minimum is what you need to get the best case scenario. And the best case scenario that they managed to generate out of these cases is 20 to 78 innocent people had to be tortured for each bad guy they got. 20 to 78 innocent people for each bad guy. Now, for every accurate piece of info, then, you have to torture in the thousands if you're professional about it. This is not retail business. This is wholesale. So you tell me, does torture work? I'll give you the opinion of the professional Gestapo. In 1942, the Czech resistance assassinated Reinhard Heydrich, Reich's protector of Czechoslovakia. Hitler wanted results. He didn't care how. He said, these guys don't listen to anything. And the Gestapo got the three bad guys, but to do that, they tortured and killed 7,545 individuals, annihilating two villages. They also got 100 resistance members on the side they weren't looking for, but that's pretty typical results. Battle of Algiers, Vietnam, we can go through them. At this point, enter Heinz von Panwitz, a career policeman and head of the Gestapo's anti-sabotage unit from Prague. He said, don't be stupid. Depend on public cooperation. Build up rapport. Put out a reward. They got over 1,000 tips, and in fact, what broke the case was when Korda, a member of the Czech resistance, betrayed the entire operation. Korda wasn't tortured. He lived well. He collected a huge reward. In fact, he lived long enough to be executed for treason after the war. The professional Gestapo repeatedly decimated the resistance through public cooperation and informers in France, Denmark, Poland, Norway, Russia, Austria, Czechoslovakia, even in the concentration camps. The Gestapo turned to torture when they lost seasoned pros like Panwitz during the war. And then they had young men with whips running around, and why would learn good policing when you've got a whip? Huge government-funded studies have proven Panwitz was right. If you don't have public cooperation, the chances that a crime will be solved falls to 10%. Pathetic results. The Gestapo knew public cooperation was the best anti-terrorist method. Public cooperation works even when time is short. July 21st, London, 7 guys get on buses with ticking bombs. The British police got all of these guys in 10 days and the ticking bombs. The big break came in 24 hours when the parents of Mokhtar Saeed Ibrahim turned their son over after seeing the security video. These were loyal British Muslims. Would they have turned their son over if they knew he was going to be not tortured? The answer is no. Good torture isn't just a source of bad intel. It destroys the only thing that really works, public cooperation. Good rapport weakens even the strongest bond we know. Good rapport restores the bond between parent and child, even when time is short. Using these techniques, during World War II, the British managed to catch 290 German spies hiding among 42,000 refugees crossing over from Europe without torturing any of them. I don't split hairs over what torture is and what is not torture. If what makes torture moral or not torture moral, if it saves innocent lives, then the truth has to be that torture is immoral, because it takes far more innocent lives than it has ever saved. And that's true for not torture. Actually, some not torture we use is even worse than torture. Take sleep deprivation. We use it all the time. Professional Spanish inquisitors wouldn't go near it. They knew sleep deprivation has hypnotic effects under repeated questioning. People will generate visions, perfect for seeing packs of the devil and Al-Qaeda everywhere. That's why crazy Scottish witch hunters used it. It was very effective. But that's them Protestants. Not a Catholic inquisitor would go near this, quote, not torture. They knew it was unreliable, and yet we use it all the time as if it gets magical results. Well, it is. It's magical thinking. That's all it is. Good torture creates bad intelligence, involves torturing thousands of innocents, while the terrorists run free. It destroys our soldiers who were forced to put in these positions. We have the studies and the organizations. And limited time makes all these effects worse, not better. That's the data. The professional Gestapo knew this. The Japanese Kempei Tai knew this. Even occasionally, a Spanish inquisitor figured this one out.
One.
With great respect, why shouldn't we not learn from them? Good counterterrorism policy depends on winning public support and building up human intelligence. Look, I used to be on the other side. I grew up in Iran under the Shah. The Shah Savak tortured terrorists, and the Shah said, I don't torture, we just have different ways of doing that. We have to be tough on these medieval radical throwbacks. They're different. And Khomeini said, medieval throwback, now look who's talking, the guys who torture. Nothing was a better recruitment tool for Islamic radicalism than not torture. And so the question is, how many countries in the Middle East do you want to lose? How many witch hunters do you want to follow? There is intelligence out there. It is time. It is really long past time for us to get our act together. Thank you.
Before we begin the discussion part of this debate, I have a question for each side. And Darius, I'll direct this to you.
Oh, thank you.
No exceptions? We've all heard about the ticking bomb scenario. A moment is precious. We need that information right away. If you agree that there can be exceptions, then where do you draw the line?
You know, Ticking Time Bomb Scenarios are wonderful stories. It was actually a wonderful novel from the French-Algerian story. It's a wonderful fantasy novel. Never happened. But I will tell you this. My book shows this. Ticking Time Scenarios, if you want to torture under those circumstances, you know what the best result, when it's going to get you the best result? During peacetime non-emergency situations, when you need it least.
I don't understand.
In other words, torture doesn't work in wartime situations when you have a ticking time bomb. You have to do, it's a volume business at that point. It is not a retail business.
I still don't understand. If you have a ticking bomb, whether it's wartime or not, and you know somebody knows that there
Look,
is.
Look, there was a ticking time bomb in World War II, in England, right? Those guys who got off the buses had a ticking time bomb. It was sitting in the bushes in Brighton outside a jail. The British got it because they had public cooperation. And if you want to torture, fine, but you'll not find that bomb.
And now to this side. David? American leadership and our security, I think we can all agree, are based, at least in part, on our alliances. And if America is seen as a, is seen in its interrogation methods as a renegade, as it has on such issues as, say, the ABM Treaty and the Kyoto Accords, won't that endanger our leadership role and thus our security if we lose that moral high ground and that leadership?
Brooke, we certainly pay a high price for it, but a couple of things need to be mentioned. First of all, unfortunately, the critics that promiscuously lump together the kind of ordinary yelling, spittle flying, psychological pressure, modest sleep deprivation, and label it with a T word, are contributing to this problem. The notion that we as a society cannot draw nuances, cannot draw distinctions between a tough treatment, which my colleague derisively referred to as non-torture and true torture, is frankly silly, because that's not what we do in ordinary life in any other difficult issues. But more importantly than that, I am not convinced, I've heard this argument many times, I'm not convinced, Brooke, that the alleged price we're paying for this aspect of our policy is sort of a but-for problem. There are so many other things that unfortunately our friends and allies do not like, because they don't take the threat of radical Islam seriously. They don't believe in serious use of military power. They're beyond that. But if we took that off the table, it would make a difference. But the thing that makes me really angry is the notion that we are helping the recruitment of jihadis, because we're talking about a culture that countenances without any problem blowing up children, torturing American prisoners to death. So if you tell me, you know, that we're people who are not troubled by that, they think it's okay. But if they read about some level of sexual degradation, humiliation being inflicted on somebody by us, that really ticks them off. I will tell you, these are the people who are not going to win their hearts and minds, no matter what try. I find this argument absolutely absurd. And the final point about how our soldiers are treated, ladies and gentlemen, our soldiers have been tortured in every single war since the end of World War II. So the notion that somehow there's this nirvana, tell this to John McCain, tell people in Korea that over 50% of American POWs were tortured and stuffed to death. Look, we have to do the right thing because it's the right thing, but let's not pretend that it's going to impact how our people are going to be dealt with by this enemy.
Go ahead, Rick.
I think one of the points you were trying to make is that it will staunch the willingness of our allies to join with us in these coalitions. I think John, you said coalition is the way we're going to go in the future. I agree with that. But I don't think that this aspect is going to play that big of a role, because when you look at the interrogation techniques that our allies use, they're much tougher than we are. Look at the way the French interrogate. Look at the way the British interrogate. I think that they go far beyond our Army Field Manual.
I would also say, in one sense, I take John Hudson's argument as really a confirmation of what we're arguing, because you didn't address stress. You talked about clear abuses of the interrogation rules. There was no license for stuffing somebody in a sleeping bag and suffocating him to death. That was a violation of the rules, not a interrogation pursuant to them.
Nobody stopped it.
And people that have killed detainees have rightly been prosecuted. Most of the deaths occurred at point of capture, not in interrogation, at that point when you are sort of still at war and it's a very ambiguous state. But in any case, out of the tens of thousands of prisoners that have been taken, 40 criminal homicides is, compared to wars in the past, is a pretty low rate. But in any case, we are not arguing for torture. My side here is talking about stress interrogation, and I would say, as David does, it is perfectly valid to distinguish between keeping somebody up late that, according to the interrogators who have written about this and spoken about this, reversing somebody's sleep schedules does get information, and burning somebody or destroying them and inflicting deliberate severe pain and stress on them and suffering on them. We have to be able to make these distinctions. And again, to conflate the murder of detainees, which is clearly a violation of the laws of war, with the calibrated use of stress, I think does no service to what we need to be debating in the future in the war on terror.
Did you want to say something before you move on?
The point is that this is not an existential war. World War II was an existential war. The Civil War is an existential war. This just happens to be the present war. And for us to sit here in 2008 and turn these people into supermen that the Nazis and Imperial Japan was not is just kidding ourselves. The problem that we face now is that nobody in the administration has said stop. Nobody said they may be terrorists, they may be evildoers, but they're human beings, and we will treat them with the dignity and respect that Americans have always treated human beings. Instead, we just let it run rampant. In 1950, the Armed Forces officer said, "Wanton killing, torture, cruelty, or the working of unusual and necessary hardships on enemy prisoners or populations is not justified under any circumstance." We have backed away from that standard, and we have permitted good American men and women to engage in a kind of interrogation policy, not because we said go out and torture, because we didn't. I mean, I'd like to have a nickel for every time the president said the United States doesn't torture. We don't engage in extraordinary rendition. But the reality of it is, what was going on there continued on. You know, you look at the pictures at Abu Ghraib. You listen to the stories of what happened at Guantanamo. Gloves off, fear down. And it was pretty clear that if it wasn't the express policy, it was the benign policy of the United States to engage in techniques that we had absolutely forbidden. In 1903, we sent an American major to prison for 10 years for waterboarding, a Filipino. We prosecuted Japanese for waterboarding and sent them to prison.
John, to say we've let it run rampant is just not true. People that have abused prisoners have been prosecuted criminally. When Abu Ghraib came out, there has been investigation after investigation of that. I would agree. I think Abu Ghraib, there has not been sufficient responsibility laid on the commanders that let that situation get out of control. I think it needs to go way far up the Pentagon chain of command that it hasn't. But again, that happened in contravention of the interrogation rules. The interrogation rules, if they had been followed to the letter, they said that every interrogation technique had to be cleared, had to be monitored. What was going on was not interrogation. This was a bunch of deranged, sadistic guards working in the middle of the night that were getting their jollies on these prisoners. It had nothing to do with the interrogation rules.
Rick?
And I think we need to put this Abu Ghraib thing to rest. And you're absolutely right. This was not the interrogations we're talking about. This was a bunch of military policemen running amok. It was a breakdown of where were their officers? Where were the NCOs? It was a complete breakdown of the chain of command. It was set up by the command in Baghdad. And there have been careers ruined for this. General Sanchez is out of the Army now. And he set up an unworkable chain of command. He put the intelligence people in charge of the prison.
But
you
some of the jollies that have been described here were techniques that were actually used in Vietnam. Somebody told them what to do. It wasn't simple improvisation.
That's right.
But may I? Having this debate, and the public should, I think, understand this. We're having this debate as if, and I think Heather articulated this point, tried to make this point, that everybody that came in on the battlefield in Afghanistan, whether they be Taliban or so-called Arab insurgent, really had a lot of information. Her position is that people were not cooperating. They were not cooperating, and because they had been trained. And the fact of the matter is, they weren't trained. The fact of the matter was, the reason why they weren't cooperating is because they didn't know anything. By and large, you have to separate the Taliban from the Arab al-Qaeda fighter. They're two distinct groups. In point of fact, they don't get along quite well. So if somebody is not cooperating, doesn't mean that they have been trained. The fact of the matter is that a lot of our people on the ground in Bagram, and I'm quite familiar with it on the military side, had no idea what they were doing.
Had not
received any training whatsoever. They were in the dark.
I'd like to return to this discussion about Abu Ghraib and those prisoners after, but first, we have two more speakers to hear from. For the motion, Rick Francona.
Well, we'll just follow up on some of this. I had several pages of notes here, but Heather and David went through them quite quickly, so I'll speak to some of the subjects that we brought up here. All this is great theory. I appreciate what all of the other speakers have brought to this, and most of the time we're talking theory. I'd like to inject some reality into this. I'm going to submit that I'm probably the only one on the stage that's been waterboarded. I don't consider it torture, but by no means do I consider it pleasant, and it's not something you sign up to do for your summer camp. The Air Force did it during our training to show us what it was like. The purpose of it was to show us the treatment that we could expect as potential prisoners of war. And the point was made, and I want to underscore this, never in our history have we gone into a conflict and our prisoners been treated right. The Geneva Convention was an attempt to make that happen. I submit that it has failed miserably. It restricts what we can do. We make sure we treat people right, and we get no reciprocal treatment at all. So it does not work. Now, John McCain will tell you that torture doesn't work and that he's against it because of his experiences in North Vietnam. No one can take away the fact that he was brutally treated, brutally tortured, and he has the gravitas to address this issue. But you have to understand that John McCain was the victim of torture for the infliction of pain. The Vietnamese were great at that. They could hurt you. They could make you say things that maybe you didn't want to say. For the most part, our prisoners did very well. They gave up what they thought their interrogators wanted to hear, which is the biggest threat you have when you resort to torture. Whoever you're torturing, the subject, is going to tell you what he thinks you want to hear. Just like a defector, we've seen how bad information leads to bad actions. Remember Curveball, the bad information about the Iraqi mobile labs. This is another instance where people tell you things they want to hear. Someone being tortured will tell you anything to stop the pain, to stop the treatment. Waterboarding, someone mentioned figure 60 to 90 seconds. I can tell you that after about 35 seconds, I was ready to tell them anything they wanted to hear, and I knew this was an exercise. And in the back of your mind, your instructors are telling you, project yourself into the situation. Imagine this to be real. I survived by telling myself, I know this is a game, and they're going to let me up before I drown. So there is that reflex. And waterboarding is so powerful that it will make you say something. So in the hands of skilled interrogators, can waterboarding work? Absolutely, but you have to know what you're doing. The North Vietnamese did not know what they were doing. They were great at inflicting pain, lousy at extracting effective, useful intelligence. Now, does it work? Well, you hate to say trust the government, but we have two government officials that say it worked. That would be the former director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, and the director of the Bin Laden unit, the Alex Station. Dr. Mike Shore, you've seen him on television. He's making the rounds. I think he has a book out. So it can be effective if it's done properly. The question is not can we do it? The question is should we do it? And that's where we have to decide, or is the tough interrogation of these suspects necessary? Do we want to go beyond whatever line that is? I can tell you the line that the government is trying to draw is the Army Field Manual. I've worked under the Army Field Manual. It's pretty restrictive. The new one is even more restrictive. They rewrote it in November of 2006. It's online. Type into Google Army Field Manual Interrogation. It's a voluminous document. It's written in typical Army bureaucratese. There's probably 4 pages in it worth reading. So, and those are the ones that tell you the 16 psychological approaches you can use, none of which will be effective against a terrorism suspect, because those techniques were written, just as someone said, to break a captured enemy soldier, one probably with no resistance training whatsoever. When we started taking large amounts of prisoners in Desert Storm, we had thousands, tens of thousands of Iraqi prisoners that we had to interrogate. We had to assess and determine if they were worth questioning. And once we determined that they were worth questioning, most of the time, if you ask them a question, they gave you the answer. It was very surprising to us to learn that all these techniques really weren't necessary because the Iraqis had no training. Most of them were happy just to be away from Saddam Hussein. Very powerful tool. The ones that did not want to cooperate with us, usually you found some major or lieutenant colonel in the Republican Guard that didn't want to talk to you. And that's when those techniques became somewhat effective. But there were always ones that would spit at you because they knew you couldn't hurt them. They knew the Americans followed the Geneva Conventions. They knew that you weren't going to hurt them. You couldn't touch them until some, and I won't use any personal references here, some lieutenant colonels I know, would throw them down to the ground, pull out a pistol, put it to their forehead, and say, tell me what I need to know, whatever the question was, or I'm going to blow your brains out. That now will get you thrown out of the Army without your retirement. Back then, it was not common use, but it was pretty effective because it's real easy in theory to know that the Americans can't hurt you. But when the gun is on your forehead, you're not sure if this is the one American that didn't get the memo. So this can be effective. Now, I think we have to be somewhat reticent in applying these forms of interrogation. But I think we would be foolish, absolutely foolish, to outlaw them. I think the president was right to veto any bill that limits what the CIA can do. And this is only limiting the CIA. The entire Department of Defense is already constrained by the Army Field Manual. The idea is to extend that to the entire government. I think that's a mistake. We still have to have this tool in our arsenal because some people in the government who've done this for a living say that it works. George Tenet said it saved lives. I don't know that to be true. I don't know it to be not true. But I think we would be very foolish to take an arrow out of the quiver. And I do think this is an existential war. And I think it is a war that we're going to be fighting for a long time. I think we need to apply every weapon we have.
Against the motion, Jack Lunin.
Good evening. I don't believe that harsh interrogation techniques actually work. I'm going to explain to you why, and I'm going to explain a little bit of my background as to why I've come to that conclusion. The question before us tonight is actually very, very important, and it's very, very important to you personally. I'm going to take us down from this sort of nuanced 30,000-foot view that we've had discussed thus far, and I'm going to take it down to what I like to call the practical level, the operator's viewpoint, because that's where I come from. That's what my job was. That's what I was charged to do. I was charged in 1996 to eliminate Bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, and others as a threat to U.S. national security. And I found myself in the enviable position of having traveled around the world and find members of Al-Qaeda and gain their cooperation. And I can assure you, as I sit here tonight, being very proud of what the end result of that was, that I did not engage in any harsh interrogation techniques. It didn't involve sleep deprivation. It didn't involve threats from dogs. It didn't involve hijinks and all the other stuff that we've heard about. We have a deficit, ladies and gentlemen, that we are facing. And that deficit has to be that we do not have, as we sit here tonight, really good human or human intelligence. Yes, we spend an awful lot of money. We can intercept and suck up emails from all around the world. But we don't really know what we have. We have a very hard time processing what we have. And when you have the opportunity to sit across the table from a real member of Al-Qaeda, a person who has raised their right hand and swore bayat or allegiance to Sheikh bin Laden, it's your obligation to get information from them and to ensure that that information is reliable. I would think even Rick would freely admit in some of his writings he has stated that harsh interrogation techniques typically don't work. In fact, rapport building is what works. We're always having this discussion about the ticking bomb, the scenario that if we don't get this information right away, when we're confronted with somebody who we believe has this sort of information, that lives will be at stake, and that we have to engage in these harsh interrogation techniques, or, as we've just described, waterboarding. When Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded, and we now know that to be the case, he was waterboarded after he was in custody for 30 days. He was waterboarded because the agency, the CIA, would argue, because what we were trying to get out of him, we weren't getting out of him. Yet I had been able to speak to people who told me rhyme and verse about Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah is not what you think he was. Abu Zubaydah was a great travel agent. He was a logistics person. He was not what has been described as a key Al-Qaeda operative, quite the opposite. So when we engage in these techniques, there is a pushback from the opposition. And what does that pushback mean to you? What does that mean to you and your families? Because when we push back and when we engage in these type of techniques, the opposition is duty-bound. The enemy, as we've heard described here tonight, is duty-bound to get revenge. There is a constituency that you have not heard from tonight, and that is Al-Qaeda. I am going to tell you what Al-Qaeda has to say about torture. I'm going to tell you what Sheikh bin Laden had to say about torture. And I'm going to tell you that from the perspective of having to deal with Ali Abdel Saud Muhammad, who created the Encyclopedia of Jihad, who taught people what to do and not to do if, in fact, arrested by the unbelievers, we, the blood people. Bin Laden's view was that any brother who was picked up and withstood torture for 72 hours, he and the other members of Al-Qaeda would not seek revenge against them. Even bin Laden understood and did not take revenge against those who cooperate with the United States. Think about that for a moment. I can talk to you about Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, which you've probably all heard about. I happen to be on the receiving end of a lot of information that Ibn Sheikh al-Libi was giving up to the FBI embargo in Afghanistan. Ibn Sheikh al-Libi is the man who's alleged to have given information that was used in Colin Powell's speech before the United Nations. Ibn Sheikh al-Libi agreed to cooperate with the United States through rapport building. And he agreed to cooperate with the United States, but he was duct taped, put into a cardboard or a plywood box, and shipped and rendered off to Egypt to be interrogated. He had agreed to cooperate with us. This was a policy decision that was made. Good counterterrorism policy has to include the end result of what we do, whether it's on the battlefield or whether it's on the streets of New York. Rapport building, treating people humanely, getting information, solid intelligence is what we're after. There's too much at stake. Your safety is at stake to engage in harsh interrogation techniques, which is going to cause the enemy to seek revenge against each of you.
Thank you. I have one last question and only a few minutes to get an answer, and I'm going to address the same question to both sides. And that is this foe different from the other foes that we faced? This foe has stated, especially the high-value prisoners, those on the inside of Al-Qaeda have stated that they are ready for death. Can you break this foe by building a rapport? Jack? Rick?
Yeah, I'll take that. Ideally, you want to break any foe. And Jack, I agree that rapport building, if you have time, is the best way to go. The question is sometimes you don't. Well, the point is sometimes you don't have the time. But I believe the foe is a different one than we've ever faced before. We're not dealing with a state. We're not dealing with someone with defined borders. These are not soldiers in an army. This is an ideal. These are committed warriors in a religious battle. And I think that brings something that we've never dealt with before, and I don't think we're very well prepared to do that.
And can I also add something that just briefly was already mentioned? The destructive power, this is an asymmetrical war, as John said. The destructive power that now lies available to individuals that are not a member of the state, that cannot be deterred as states can, is unlike anything that we've faced before with the availability of nuclear weapons.
Our distinguished colleagues don't have their act together. Jack seems to be arguing that it is silly to counterproductively use stress techniques and accomplish a lot of rapport. Nobody disagrees. Nobody would be a fool to suggest we should promiscuously use stress techniques. But it's equally foolish to say we should never use them, because there may be circumstances where they're necessary. And the true wisdom lies in ascertaining which one is which. And mistakes can be made. But wouldn't it be a mistake, Jack, to just take something entirely off a table? Do you think that everybody is subject to
that? That's a sentence?
Let me address this to Jack first, because you raised the issue of rapport building as an effective way to get actionable intelligence.
That's not what I'm saying. I use the word rapport building, certainly. Did I engage in harsh interrogation techniques? Of course I did. But harsh doesn't mean that I was engaging in sleep deprivation. It doesn't mean that I was engaging in some of these other techniques that we've now all identified. The harshest thing I ever had to do was to let somebody listen to Barry Manilow for 24 hours. That would be considered...
Sounds awful.
You know, doesn't it? Honestly. No. What I'm saying is that there is this supposition out there that Al-Qaeda is everywhere. There's this supposition that the Taliban, you know, is Al-Qaeda, and we fail to make distinctions between that. If I asked the audience tonight, and I'll ask my distinguished colleagues up here, and David, you can be the first one, how many members of Al-Qaeda do you think there are?
Oh, boy. Is this a multiple choice?
I mean, the other side is arguing that this enemy is so vast, so depraved, so craven, they want to kill thousands of us. There's no question about that. There's no question that what they want to do. We saw that. But my point to you is, when I took the original membership list off of Ali Muhammad for Al-Qaeda, there were 72 members.
There's probably a lot more now.
Well,
the cell structure within Al-Qaeda consists of 4 to 6 operatives. You are trying to find on a beach, a small dime. That's what we're up against.
But Jack, that's a different argument. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they have a million or 10,000. Again, given the availability of weapons of mass destruction, that's what we're up against, and that's the fear that
a
small number of people.
What are the weapons of mass destruction that they have?
Airplanes? There is the possibility
they don't have
nuclear weapons.
Well, come on.
You don't. You think it's not going to happen?
You think Al-Qaeda's got nuclear weapons?
I'm going to break in here.
Oh, well, come on. I mean,
it's not a possibility. I'm glad.
Relentlessly seeking.
Rick may know this. Al-Qaeda first tried to get fissionable material in 1993. What they got was red mercury. They got scammed.
Yeah.
And we got that from what? We got that from one of the guys that we cooperated with. So not only did we learn about what they were trying to do, we knew how they went about it.
I hope that will prompt the audience to raise questions about the actual nature and the extent of the threat. I'm going to be turning to you in just a moment, but first, I want to announce the results of the pre-debate vote. And before the debate, for the motion, which is, I want to have the exact wording here, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary, 46% of you voted for the motion, 35% voted against the motion, 19% were undecided. So much for some on the panel that thought this was going to be an excessively liberal audience. So now I'd like to open up the floor for Q&A. Please stand up when you have your question. I ask that you don't start to ask your question until you have the microphone. This is radio. Please make the questions short and to the point. And it would be great if members of the press would identify themselves as such. Have we got a question ready? All right.
The arguments on both sides so far have been mostly utilitarian. Torture works, torture doesn't work, torture has side effects, but there hasn't been much said about the moral high ground and America showing leadership in an ethical and moral universe. The do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What about the moral issue in here, which I think is a problem that many of us have?
Can I just say very briefly, let the record show that nobody's arguing on our side in favor of torture. The shame, frankly, the fault lies with the critics that damn everything with a T word and paint with a broad brush. We're not talking about torture. We're talking about the level of coerciveness and unpleasantness that permeates our spheres of public life without drawing any opposition from anybody. You tell me why, in order for us to occupy the moral high ground, we should eschew, give up, whatever verb you want to use, a level of coercion that is routinely used in other areas, including training of our own troops, specialized and advanced training, federal and state penitentiaries, boot camps for juvenile offenders. That makes no sense for us as a society to, instead of having a common baseline, but it's not torture, to have privilege, uniquely privileged, only one set of people captured Al-Qaeda and Taliban terrorists. If that is morality, it's silly.
That's David Rivkin. Darius Rajali, do you want to try this one on?
Sure, I'll take that on. Look, you keep on saying that we do these things domestically and we should do them internationally, and what's the problem? Well, a couple of problems. First of all, let me just say a couple of things. If a young professor comes to me and he says, "Can you tell me exactly what sexual harassment is? I mean, if I do a little bit of it, is it okay?" You'd think that's creepy, right? These people are talking about, let's do a little bit of it, and it's creepy, and it should creep you out, okay? Because there are certain things you shouldn't get anywhere near. The line between domestic and international, whatever you want to call these things, not torture, is a thin one. In every war that we have used torture, the Philippines, when we use that in insurgency, those guys, they come home, what kind of jobs do they get? They get jobs as policemen, prison guards, and your private security officials. And behind them follows torture, or not torture, call it what you will. Chicago is paying $20 million, thanks to Mr. Burge and his 50 detectives who brought all their lovely techniques back from Vietnam. Look, at the end of this war, whether these guys get their way or not, people are coming back. And they're going to be your cops, your neighborhood officials. They're going to be your private people. And yes, there is a difference between domestic and international, but this stuff travels.
Darius,
Let me make another point, too. That if this is important for us to do, to save American lives, because we've got this superhuman enemy that we have never faced before, because this foe is different and they are so dedicated, if this is important for us to do at some level, then to the moral imperative question, why should we stop at all? Why not the rack? Why not perfidy? Why not treachery? Why not all kinds of things? Because if that's the moral thing to do in order to save lives, then by George, we ought to be doing it across the board and not stopping ourselves anywhere short. I think that the world has relied, and the United States has been far from perfect. Our history is replete with examples of where we have failed in big things and in little things. But the world has relied on us to stand for the rule of law and for human rights. And it's not a rule of law if you only apply it when it's convenient. And it's not a human right if it only applies to some people. We need to stand tall in this and not draw lines, because this enemy is the worst enemy we have ever faced.
Let me just argue that, first of all, what we are doing is within the rule of law, because a terrorist detainee is not covered by the Geneva Conventions.
It's how you define the law.
And he is covered by the Convention Against Torture. There is no question. We are obligated to follow the Convention Against Torture. That's why it matters to make the distinctions that Darius refuses to. We are not arguing torture on this side. And Darius, you seem to think that the only possible set of questioning techniques are these random, it was rather arbitrary what got put into the Army Field Manual. You yourself know there has been, contrary to the claims on the other side, there has been no serious empirical work on the Army Field Manual. Are you suggesting that those are the only possible questioning techniques that can ever be used, and that somehow they are handed down from on high as the absolute way of questioning? There may have been 12. If Mutt and Jeff had not originally been included in them, my guess is that if we were now
Mutt and Jeff are good cop, bad
good
cop,
cop
for people
bad
who
cop.
Don't know the...
You would call that torture as well, because that wouldn't be...
No, actually, Heather, I think you're getting your distinctions
again,
quite all confused
to, we
here.
We need to discuss whether stress is torture.
All right, Heather.
Listen, I'm the one who argued for public cooperation, because Al-Qaeda is like a fish in a sea. You need to push it out of the water. It's a small group of people, and you need to have Iraqi civilians like come in and turn people in. I have not been the one who argued for the interrogation manual. I have said that all the studies show that unless you have public cooperation on your side, the chances that you will be able to clear and solve a crime will fall to 10%, regardless of how you interrogate them, right? So it doesn't matter what you throw at this problem, right? And the more you do your not torture stuff, the more problematic it is. Let me get to another thing. Barbaric, different kind of enemy, sure. They're vengeful. And in the Middle East, they never forget. You know this. You know that in the Middle East, they never forget. You can get away with this. Do they have weapons of mass destruction? Well, as I understand, Mr. Alibi, after he was beaten up by the Egyptians, actually said that Saddam Hussein trained Al-Qaeda in weapons of biological and chemical destruction. The Pentagon yesterday produced this huge report that proved that this was entirely false, but it went into the president's speech in October in 2002 and was part of the case that took us to war. And let me tell you, I don't know how many lives these not torture techniques have saved, but I can tell you how many lives it's taken. It's taken everybody who's died.
All right. Wait a moment. I have to apologize. I have taken this debate out of sequence, and you guys are supposed to ask each other questions now. So let me hurry up and get some of those in. And if you don't mind, I'll begin with Heather. Heather, do you have a question for the other side?
Well, I'm just puzzled by the idea that if you have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in detention, I'm not sure what the public cooperation is that you're going to expect to get information from him. The 9/11 Commission report, you're claiming that interrogation stress did not work. They said that half of the information in that report came from the interrogation of
high value. Is that the question?
Yeah. Why are you disagreeing with the fact that the interrogation of high value detainees did produce valuable intelligence that allowed us to?
In the case of Abu Zubaydah, the information that was of high value was not stuff that he gave up after he was waterboarded. The real critical stuff was in the apartment where he was seized. He jumped out the back window, and in the apartment was a treasure trove of computers, documents, cell phones, and the like. And so when they started to do their routine grunt work and do the document exploitation and all that other stuff, that's what led ultimately to the arrest, if you will, or the capture of Khalid Sheikh and Ramzi bin al-Shib.
That was Jack Clunan. John Hudson, have you got a question for the other side?
Yes, I do.
The side in favor of the proposition?
Yes. There's been a lot of talk about the Army Field Manual and the difference now between DOD and the CIA. The President just recently vetoed the intelligence bill, which would have made the CIA subject to the Army Field Manual. The Army Field Manual says, use of torture by U.S. personnel would bring discredit upon the United States and its armed forces while undermining domestic and international support for the war effort. Not making a distinction between the CIA and the Army, just talking about domestic and international support. It could also place U.S. and allied personnel in enemy hands at greater risk of abuse.
There's a question there, right?
Well, there's going to be. Which of, now the Army Field Manual, or the intelligence bill that the Army Field, that would have incorporated the Army Field Manual, has the following prohibitions. Which of these prohibitions would you say is okay for the CIA and therefore for the United States? Forcing a prisoner to be naked, perform sexual acts. This is what the President vetoed. Forcing a prisoner to be naked, perform sexual acts, or pose in a sexual manner. Placing hoods or sacks over the head of a prisoner and using duct tape over their eyes. Applying beatings, electric shots, burns, and other forms of physical pain. Waterboarding, military working dogs, hypothermia or heat injury, mock executions, and depriving a prisoner of necessary food, water, and medical care. Now, which of those do you think it's okay for the CIA on behalf of the United States to engage in order to get information?
Rick, do you want to take that one?
Well, since I think he's reading from my article.
No, actually, I'm not.
That's the field manual, right? This is what the Army is prohibited from doing. I'm not saying the CIA should be allowed to do any or all of these. I'm just saying you shouldn't extend this manual to the CIA. The CIA operates under different rules.
But you
want to go through and then the CIA manual could be more specific.
He gave you a multiple choice question here because these were this bill was vetoed.
But that's, with all due respect, John, that's not all that the Army Field Manual does. My favorite example is, and I wish I had it in front of me, if you look at the definition of a good cop versus bad cop, there's a restriction on how bad a bad cop can be. The bad cop cannot act in a manner that's disrespectful to the person being interrogated. I would submit to you, it's not a question of violating the law on the domestic side. In virtually every police station, the bad cop is pretty damn disrespectful to the drug dealers and rapists and muggers. We're talking about using the rules. We're not using our criminal justice system. That, John, is absurd. It's insanity. It's not morality.
But he's citing the...
But he's citing selectively the Army Field Manual.
And he's asking you to respond selectively.
I feel as though I have to defend all the good police officers and law enforcement officers out there, because I can assure you that doesn't go on as much as David suggested it does. It just doesn't.
Bad cop does not yell.
No,
spittle is not
I'm saying, but...
Threats are not made.
But you keep talking about these extreme views. You keep talking in the extreme. What I'm trying to argue here is, and I think we've done it rather successfully, frankly, is to tell you that when you speak in the extremes and you speak in the absolutes, that there is going to be problems. I don't think you have sat across, maybe you have sat across the table from one of these guys and tried to get information. Heather, maybe you have. I suspect that Rick has. I don't know. But I will tell you, if you had, you'd walk away from that experience being very humble and understanding what you're up against. To the gentleman's question about the moral imperative, if you think, ladies and gentlemen, and my distinguished colleagues over here, that we can defeat this enemy with guns and bullets and throwing money at this, you're wrong. This is an epic struggle. This is a struggle for the next generation, and it's the biggest challenge that we're going to have to face. And I don't want to make it any more difficult than what it is. And when you engage in some of the things that have been, I'm not saying some of the things that we've discussed here tonight, you make that challenge a lot harder for us.
David, do you have a question?
Two very
David
brief
Rifkin,
questions.
Do you one question for the other why, side
all right,
against the motion?
Why do you claim that false, misleading information and lying only emanates from people who have been interrogated as trespassers? The last time I checked, every criminal, every terrorist routinely lies, and your job as interrogator is to sift the truth from fiction. Isn't it the case that the biggest problem is the person says nothing, zero, nada? Not the fact that somebody is lying, because you have enough time to cross-reference things. You can learn as much from lying as from a person doing truth-telling. But everybody lies.
Okay. Does anybody
there's
want?
No kidding.
Yes. Well, look, there's lots of collection.
Guys,
the question is analysis.
Guys lie.
Look, the guilty will lie no more nor less. The problem is a selection problem. You have a fuzzy context in which you can't tell who is a big fish, who's a small fish, who is not Al-Qaeda, who isn't. These are people who hide as ordinary civilians. You've all admitted this, right? So you have a selection problem. You have to pull in large numbers of people, and there you have to decide who is guilty and who is innocent. The guilty, you're right, absolutely will lie no more or less if you do whatever you want to do to them, right? But the innocent, oh my God, if you start torturing the innocent at 20 to 78 at that rate, you're going to produce a mound of false information. You're weighing down the exact war effort you want to win. And not only that, I ask you, what American value does it promote to torture 20 to 78 innocents to get your one hit?
Actually, Darius, it's your time to ask a
question.
Asked
that question.
Do you want to ask that? Yeah. Did you guys get that?
But that's a straw man. Nobody is suggesting that. This administration, that's much maligned, has used the stress interrogation techniques against very few high-value detainees. And whether or not a given individual, as Jack suggested, was more of a braggart or versus a real mastermind, he wasn't innocent. The few people who were subjected to those techniques were anything but innocent.
Look,
it tortures us just like virginity.
I don't think.
It,
go ahead.
You're a torturer. You know, it's a one-time deal. If it's not necessarily counting or saying, well, these people above this line are high values, so we can torture them. Below this line, they're not. So you know. Once you've done it, once you've engaged in it, that's who you are as a nation.
John, but you got to deal with this. What you are suggesting we're doing. First of all, you guys don't have your act together. The two people on both sides are making a utilitarian argument. It doesn't work. We don't need it. You're making an absolute argument that there are certain things called torture that you should never do. Actually, we agree. The question is this. Are we going to be a mature society? We have a serious discourse about what isn't torture. It's distasteful, but it's necessary. We're going to just flap our hands and say everything is torture.
Well, no, a mature society has a debate about what good counterterrorism policy is, not what good torture is.
Rick, have you... Rick, I'm sorry, hold on a moment. Rick Francona, do you have a question for the side against the motion?
I suppose I could form this in a question.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't. Rick has to go.
All right.
I'm sorry.
I think it was, Darius, you said that the motivation for cooperation, the public, you use the public cooperation is how you would round these guys up. I'm not sure that's always the case. Would you say that's why Al-Qaeda in Iraq is being taken apart by the Anbar cooperative group out there? They're doing it because we're going to kill them, not because we're not going to be nice to them.
You know, one of the nasty things about Al-Qaeda, and this is true about all terrorist torture, let's be clear. These people are barbarians, right? They chop off heads. They're incompetent at it. They know they're going to get a rise out of us.
I have relatives. Let me be honest with you. I have relatives who used to collect eyeballs, right? Beheading is ridiculous, as it's clearly a bait, and it's clearly designed to get us to make mistakes. Now, one of the things any Oriental ruler would have known is not to fall for that bait, right? Terrorists don't have fixed assets. They don't have jails. They don't have places. They have to be on the run. They have to depend on safe houses. What I'm finding right now in Al Anbar is we're finding torture chambers. You know what that means? It means they're feeling comfortable enough to build torture chambers. That is not good.
Oh, wait a minute. It doesn't work, so it must hurt them more than it hurts
them.
Oh,
it works. I'll tell you what it works for. It works to intimidate. It works to make false confessions. I am happy to stipulate that, although I will say this, too. We have all the records of French torture from the Ancien Régime. And we know that these guys boiled people's feet in oil. They waterboarded. Do you know how many actually said anything? Do we have a single document left of them in confession? 3 to 14%. That's what false confessions are. Now, let's not even worry about the true and false confessions. The other part of this is you think that, well, if the guy breaks, oh, I'll know whether it's true or not. Again, 40 years of psychological research will tell you this. We're really, really bad at telling the difference between truth and lies, even interrogators. We've tested them. I'm sorry. There is no argument here.
Jack Clunan, please direct the next question to...
I'll direct this to Rick. Rick, what is the best way to get quality, actionable intelligence to protect this audience?
I don't think there's an argument. I agree with what you said. Establishing rapport.
Come sit over here.
Rick, I don't understand what you're doing over there. I honestly don't. I mean...
Hang on. We got Rick.
There's a comma here. Given, you know, in a perfect world, and if you had time to establish that rapport. But many times, you don't have the time to do that. You're not sure you have the time to do that. The biggest problem is not what you know about a suspect. It's about what you don't know. And what you don't know is what's the timeline. And you have to get to that very quickly. And if you have any reason to believe that he's got information of an imminent value, then you've got to ramp up the treatment. Ideally, if you think this guy, okay, this is a low-level Taliban guy who probably doesn't know much, let's sit down and talk to him and find out who we might know, where the training camps are, the routine order of battle kind of stuff you'd want to prosecute a war. But if you grab a guy, maybe Bin Laden's driver, who was driving a set of orders somewhere, but you don't know where, it'd be nice to know where that is before the action happens.
I would now like to open up the floor to a couple of other questions. We've run long. Sure, right over there.
Hi, I'm Gabriel.
Can you wait for the microphone? It's coming your way.
Gabriel Schoenfeld from Commentary Magazine. My question is for Heather McDonald. Heather, help me out here with your teammates on this waterboarding question. I heard Rick Francona say when he was subjected to it voluntarily, he broke after 30 seconds. David Rifkin says 60 to 90 seconds isn't torture. That seems like a long time for some. Rick Francona has it right. And second, Rick Francona cites Michael Scheuer and George Tenet as sources saying that waterboarding was effective. But are those two credible? Is George Tenet credible? He, of the slam dunk assessments, and Michael Scheuer, who is going around the country saying that Israel is running clandestine operations against the United States through the Holocaust Museum?
Well, that's quite a question.
Well, I wasn't aware of Michael Scheuer's testimony. I would rely on the 9/11 Commission report. I don't know what the relevance is of the seconds that people have held out, but clearly we have gotten actionable intelligence from the high-value CIA detainees. What I don't understand is obviously we do need to think about this not just as a utilitarian matter, but a moral one. But why is it necessarily the moral position to say that we are not going to use stress on a single Al-Qaeda detainee and risk the possible destruction of hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent civilians. To me, it's not clear that the moral position puts more value on the protecting of temporary extreme discomfort of one person who is pledged to destroy as many Americans as he can, that's moral to protect him and to sacrifice thousands of American lives. The idea that stress does not work, never works, is an easy out. The fact is that regimes have used torture, again, which is not what we are arguing for today, but even torture has been shown to work. The French used it in the Algerian War, and they got information.
No.
They did.
Evidently, no.
They used.
Let's hear that one. Uh-huh. Let's hear the evidence. Let's hear the evidence. 24,000 arrests. 24,000 police arrest. Let's call them torture warrants, right? To catch what? How many in the Kasbah? Do you know how many there were? You guys don't know how many Al-Qaeda there were.
We
are ready now for
1,400.
1,400.
24,000 tortured for 1,400, most of whom actually died and went actually over to the French as informers.
We've run nearly out of time. I want everybody to have their two-minute closing remarks. Can we begin with John Hudson against the motion?
Thank you. And thank you all for your patience. I started out some time ago now talking about the various considerations that we've been talking about tonight, legal, moral, diplomatic, practical. But let me go to the one very quickly that I think is, for me, most convincing. The enemy can't beat us militarily. They've got no lift. They've got very little communication. They've got IEDs. They've got suicide bombers. They cannot defeat the United States of America militarily. But I'll tell you how we can lose this war on terror. We can commit national suicide. And the way we'll commit national suicide is by disarming ourselves, by giving up our greatest weapon. And our greatest weapon isn't our military might or our natural resources or the essential island nature of our land mass.
One.
It sure as heck isn't our economy right now. Our great strength is, Bono and Thomas Paine had it right, is who we are. And if we give up who we are as a nation, that's a victory for the enemy. The enemy knows they can't defeat us militarily. Killing us isn't their goal. Our will to win, defeating our will to win, isn't the enemy's goal. The enemy's goal in the war on terror is to bring us down to them, to make us ever so slightly more like they are, to make us as miserable and pathetic as they are. And if we engage in the same tactics, they will have won that particular battle.
Heather? Thank you very much, John Hudson. Now, Heather McDonald for the motion.
Well, I agree with the opponents that we need as highly trained interrogators as we can get. They should be as fully versed in language and cultural skills, and that is clearly has been a weakness. But I would submit that the trained interrogators with the CIA were facing resistance that the existing tools that they had available to them was not able to overcome. And I don't believe that the 16 Army interrogation rules are the only possible interrogation techniques that should ever be available as we face an enemy that is not going to seek revenge because we are using stress, because they wanted to kill us 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and destroy as much as we can. I think that there are going to be times when stress is necessary. If we are facing an imminent threat, if we have somebody with knowledge of the next plot, we're not going to have time to spend the months that it can take to build rapport. And if using stress on somebody with knowledge of the next terrorist attack is necessary to save thousands of American lives, I think that it is acceptable and lawful and moral to do so.
Against the motion, Darius Rejali.
Is it better to be loved or feared? Loved or feared? The correct answer is that if you can fight with one hand tied behind your back and win, you will be loved and feared. And that's the American way. If you want to be merely loved, you'll be despised. If you really want to be feared, you'll be despised. My great-grandfather wanted to be feared. He was a very powerful Persian prince. He didn't hesitate to torture and kill anyone who got in his way. He clothed his values in blood, and no one misses him today, and his world is gone. I accepted this invitation today, regardless of this debate, win or lose, just to tell you all one thing I know. Don't make the same mistake my great-grandfather did. Don't make the same mistake the Shah of Iran did. No one will miss you either. Do not close the values that I have come to this country for. Do not close them in blood and make them a sham. I am really tired of having to move.
One.
And your parents were really tired of having to move. Look, you can follow bagpipes into battle if you want, but the reality doesn't change. In the end, the Pied Piper keeps on playing all that hot air, the boys at the front die, and the pipers go back to the think tanks and have fine careers. You can't win a football game with a bunch of Hail Marys. You can't do it based on interrogation, based on faith. We've told you the only thing that really works: public cooperation, rapport building. And if you're still on the fence and you don't know where to vote, I just have it on good authority, by the way, that Rick Francona is a card-carrying member of Red Sox Nation.
For the motion, David Rifkin.
We are facing a very serious threat. One of the reasons that is the case is not a question of numbers. It's not even a question of technology. It's the question of dedication. It's been decades since we fought people who, no matter how twisted and warped the ideology is, willing to commit the most inhuman acts, sacrificing not only himself, mothers bringing their children up to die, expressing pride at that. The force of that compulsion, of that conviction, is tremendously dangerous. I would suggest to you that we had a lot of emotional statements today, in my opinion, not emanating from our side of this equation, but I ask you to use your rule of reason. We as human beings are all about making nuances. Whether we're dealing with our kids, our coworkers, dealing with our government. What we've heard repeatedly from our opponents is extolling you not to try to draw distinctions, not to try to rule the rule of reason, but basically adopt a rigid, unyielding framework, suggesting that anything that deviates from this framework, but degrees of coercion, which, by the way, if practiced in the criminal justice system, would absolutely allow most criminals to go free, because we would not be able to suggest them to any psychological coercion or threaten them or their family members in any way. That is not the way America has gotten to where it is. This is not the way you're going to lead your own lives. This is not the way you're going to lead your professional lives. Why should you lead that approach as citizens of this great party polity? Use the rule of reason. Don't worry about anecdotes about Spanish Inquisition or the Iranian secret police.
Against the motion, Jack Lunin.
I think, honestly, that we all on this stage tonight have learned something about each other, and I think that we all want to get to the same position. I firmly believe that. I think that we have a different way of going about it, and we may differ in methodology. I believe, on our side, in our argument, and I'm not making this just based on moral grounds, I'm making this from the position of a utilitarian, practical application of what I know to work. And that because we have such a huge deficit in our ability to collect solid, good intelligence, I don't want to waste the time trying to find that little dime I mentioned to you on the beach. We don't have time to do that. The enemy, as David suggested, is very committed. Bin Laden has issued a fatwa, and in that fatwa he has declared war on the United States, and he has said that it's the duty of every good Muslim to kill Americans wherever they find them. The question is, how am I going to protect you? How is our government going to protect you? And the best way to do that, it seems to me, is what we've been advocating on this side. Let's be clear. Stress can be defined any number of different ways. What we're talking about are extreme measures, and those extreme measures don't work, haven't worked, and it sets us up for cataclysmic results, which means, as Darius pointed out, revenge of the worst sort. And we haven't seen the worst yet. We haven't seen the repercussions of what Abu Ghraib has represented in others. Trust me when I say that.
For the motion, Rick Francona.
I was struck by your question, sir, and I really appreciate you asking that about the moral high ground. Do we lose by not adhering to the moral high ground? Trust me, and I think all of us are on the same sheet. No one wants to use these techniques as a matter of course. No one enjoys this. From those of us who have done this, it's not a very pleasant experience. But we don't live in a perfect world. We didn't create that world, and it is inhabited by people that do want to kill us. And I'm not sure revenge is the factor. It's their stated goal in life for whatever reason. Is this utilitarian? Yes. It's the mission of the intelligence community and the armed forces to protect the country through whatever means or is legally possible. And when you're lucky enough to get your hands on one of these suspects, and it's very difficult to do, how do you find them? These are all very good points. Once you get your hands on one, you have to be able to get the information you need. If the rapport building works, great. If it doesn't, you've got to be able to ratchet it up and get what you have to have. They can't defeat us militarily, but I am not willing to risk the death of thousands of Americans just on the moral high ground. You can't have it both ways.
Thank you all very much. Now it's time for you to decide who carried the day. Once again, please pick up the keypad attached to the left armrest of your seat after my prompt. Press 1 if you are for the motion. Tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary. 2 if you are against the motion. 3 if you are undecided. Please cast your vote now. I want to thank the debaters and the audience for their good work. Before I announce the results of the audience vote, I just want to take care of a couple of things. The next Intelligence Squared U.S. debate will be on Tuesday, April 15th, here at Asia Society and Museum. The motion to be debated is, Islam is dominated by radicals. It will be moderated by NPR's Robert Siegel. The panelists for the next debate are, for the motion, Vice President of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, David Gartenstein-Ross, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, Paul Marshall, and former reporter for the Wall Street Journal and visiting scholar at Georgetown University, Azra Q. Namani. Against the motion will be Assistant Professor at the University of California, Riverside, and Senior Fellow at the USC Center on Public Diplomacy, Reza Aslan, Professor of History at Columbia University, Richard Bulliet, and Adina Lekovic, Director of Communications for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. An edited version of tonight's Intelligence Squared U.S. debate can be heard locally here on WNYC AM 820 on Sunday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. These debates are also heard at 140 NPR stations across the country, and you can check your local NPR member station listings for the time and dates for broadcasts outside of New York City. And here are the responses. Before the debate, you had 46% in favor, 35 against, and 19 undecided. After the debate, you have 40% in favor, 53% against, and 7% undecided. Thank you very much.